And now Radio CJ, hosted by CJ Grace.
Chances are you've turned on a switch or two to light up your home today and used several appliances to get your breakfast ready. Maybe a refrigerator, a stove, a toaster, a kettle, or a coffee maker. We take it for granted that apart from the rare power outage, electricity will always be there. My guest today knows exactly what it's like for people to live without electricity. Jeff Lahl is the project director for Solar Electric Light Fund, an NGO that designs and implements solar energy systems to bring electricity to communities in the third world who have never had access to electricity before. Jeff, thank you for being on my show.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
You say your work brings you instant gratification. Why is that?
Well, as you say, villages that don't have electricity and have never had it, the effects are immediate. I'll never forget my first experience in the Kingdom of Tonga. I was working for the government energy ministry there, and our project was to develop solar electricity in very small remote islands. So the first project we had was a very small island called Maunga'una, and we lived there for a month installing solar systems. We would go house to house, and after about 3 to 4 weeks, we had installed about 50 homes. By their own agreement, no one turned on their lights until everyone could do it at the same time. So the church bells rang, everybody flipped the switch, and that was a transformative experience both for them and for me. After that, people were crying. They were saying they wished their parents were alive to see this. They couldn't believe they had electricity. And our Tongan crew were getting marriage proposals. So we felt like the sun gods, the sun kings at that point. And for me, that was a transformative experience. I decided, wow, this is magical. And it's really quite easy. And it's really quite inexpensive. And I think from that point on, the seed was planted that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
You were in the Peace Corps at that time, weren't you?
I was. I was doing a 2-year Peace Corps tour in Tonga, South Pacific.
And there was something else you did for the Tongans. Didn't you build an ambulance service when they didn't have anything like that before?
Well, yeah. In the Peace Corps, you're encouraged to have, you're given a main job, and then you're encouraged to develop a secondary project. So at the time I went into the Peace Corps, I was working as a part-time volunteer emergency medical technician for a fire department in Sedona, Arizona. So I was very much in the mode of emergency medicine at that time. And I looked around Tonga when I arrived and asked our Peace Corps medical officer, does Tonga have an ambulance service? And the answer was no. She said, but however, we do have 2 empty ambulances. So that became my secondary project. I received funding from grants through the Peace Corps, from the Australian Embassy, and a few private donors. And 2 years later, they had a working ambulance service. We renovated the 2 ambulances, got them equipped. I did quite a bit of training of Tongan nurses. It was actually 7 women and 1 man, which was fantastic. These nurses couldn't believe the opportunity to expand their skills. At that time in Tonga, nurses were treated, not real respectfully. They were definitely the servants of the doctors. So this kind of gave them a leg up. This gave them some special knowledge, and they were thrilled and they were excited. So, and I was too. We also received some assistance from the U.S. military. At that time, the U.S. Marines were doing annual training with the Tongan Military Defense Forces. And the Marines carry Navy medics with them. So I was able to request 2 weeks of training from Navy medics, which was just first-class training. So that was an extremely rewarding experience. The system was working when I left.
When was that? What year was it?
95. At the completion of the training course, the Queen of Tonga herself gave out the diplomas to the nurses. So it was quite a big deal. The nice thing about Tonga is that you could be a big fish in a small pond and get a lot of things done.
Were you invited to a rugby match as well? at one point?
Yeah, one of our first jobs as an ambulance corps was to be the medical corps at Rugby between the Tongans Sea Eagles versus the New Zealand All Blacks. So the All Blacks, of course, are an international powerhouse in rugby. So that was really thrilling to be part of that as well.
And they scared everybody with a haka dance at the beginning, the haka haka dance.
They scared me, not so much the Tongans. The Tongans do not scare easily. So, and they're, of course, some of the biggest people on earth. So it was pretty exciting.
And who won the match?
The All Blacks.
Not too much of a surprise.
No.
So that was how it started. And SELF has installed over 550 solar energy systems in 16 countries so far. What was your most challenging project, would you say?
Nigeria, yeah. For several reasons. It was my first project in Africa, actually. And to be honest, I didn't quite know what I was getting into in Nigeria. I was working as a contractor for SELF at that time and had just done a couple design projects for them and one project in the Bahamas. So when I was offered a chance to go to Africa, I jumped at it. Again, being quite ignorant about Africa and especially Nigeria. So Nigeria was challenging from the standpoint of it's a difficult place to work officially and that the government doesn't work very well and it doesn't work at all without bribes. And it was just a tough place to work. On the positive side, we worked with a local NGO that was actually a spin-off of a state government up there. And their mandate was to develop renewable energy. So they did the bulk of the work. It was just myself and them. And they were fantastic. And that's what made the project. We had a group of dedicated Nigerians who really cared. And we learned together. We worked in three villages. We provided electricity for schools, clinics, water wells, streetlights, and a few homes. Oh, as well as a microenterprise center to help them develop businesses. So it was a long project. It took a couple of years to actually realize from the beginning to the end of the installations. It took three trips before we even ordered equipment to actually get the government red tape in line and to actually take our time and find out what people really wanted and needed in these villages. In fact, we maybe spent a little too much time doing needs assessment because I'll never forget my last trip. I was surrounded by villagers. We were sitting down and we were going over now, okay, we understand you want this and you want this, but you don't need this. And someone raised their hand and they said, Jeff, we really appreciate you coming here and talking to us, but when are you going to bring something? So, and it was a fair point, but we were trying to make sure that what we did was driven by their needs and not by what we thought they needed. And so I feel like we accomplished that.
So you spent 3 months there in 2003 doing the nitty-gritty work for that project. What are your high points and low points from that period?
Oh, that was a long time ago. But I'd say the high points were the people I worked with. Again, the Nigerian NGO was excellent. They became very good friends of mine and a very warm relationship and a very nice professional relationship. The other high point was the villagers themselves. I had spent enough time there, both on the assessment phase and the installation phase, that I got to know the villagers. And they got to know me to the point where, you know, we had joking relationships and, you know, joking that I should marry someone in the village and stay there. So that made it a very rich experience on the ground. So that was the positive side. The negative side, again, was the bureaucracy, trying to get things out of customs that, you know, took months and dealing with red tape. And, you know, I think the living conditions were challenging as well. They were fine and I had plenty to eat, but you know, there was no variety and there seemed to be a sauce served with everything, absolutely everything that I didn't like. So
what kind of sauce was that?
Tomato based, but it had a certain spiciness that just didn't taste good to me, but it was a staple. So I ate it daily. And I guess the positive side of that is I lost a lot of weight on that trip.
And you didn't get super sick or anything like that from the food?
No, I did really well. I was sick for 2 days in the whole 2 year period, so I consider myself pretty lucky there.
And were there times when you never saw any white people at all and they almost looked strange to you?
That was interesting. Yeah, in that 3 month period, we were in the field, we were in villages, and this is in remote northern Nigeria in Jigawa State, and very remote, and there's very little development, and therefore there's very few Caucasian people up there, very few Europeans or Americans. And I went weeks, maybe a couple of months without seeing another white person. And I was also living in a place with no mirror. So when I saw white people and when I saw myself in the mirror after a few months, it was a little bit shocking.
You weren't too happy with what you saw in the mirror. It looked odd to you.
Yeah, us white people looked odd after a while. You just adjust to your environment after a while.
So what makes a project succeed and what makes a project fail, would you say?
Generally, what makes it succeed is the ability to sustain it once it's installed and once it's working. We've been successful in all of our projects in terms of doing good assessments and in terms of installing, you know, properly sized systems that do what they're supposed to with very good equipment and very good quality of installation. So then after that, that's when the challenge begins. And all of our projects include training of the local people so that they're able to maintain and do a certain amount of repair work. But as our systems have gotten bigger and more sophisticated over the years, it requires more and more training. And that local capacity doesn't always exist there. And in fact, you know, a case in point, we've been working in Haiti since before the earthquake there. And in our own experience, we found people that just weren't trained to do advanced work there. There was no real trained cadre of solar technicians. So we took it upon ourselves there to create a National Solar Training Center, which is just fielding its first class of 30 students right now. But essentially, in most countries where we work, there's not real good capacity. And what we try to do is to get our funders or donors to fund several years of sustainability into the project, where they can afford to have us maintain the system or help a local solar company maintain the system or train a local solar company to maintain it. And so the training is a big part of it. And then the other part of it is replacing equipment. Solar panels will last a long time. They'll last 20, 25 years, no problem, if they're not stolen or broken. So, and that does not happen very often. So we're not worried about the solar. The electronics will typically last 8, 10, 12 years. So they're not a big problem because they're not too expensive. But the problem is batteries. The batteries are 30 to 40% of the cost of the system. And when they go down anywhere from 5 to 10 years down the road, there typically is not local money to replace them. So that is the biggest single challenge that we face. So we try and address that in a couple ways. With our donors, again, we ask them to fund the first replacement of batteries so that at least we know those systems will be working 6 to 12 to 15 years down the road. However, very few donors are actually willing to bank that amount of money for future expenditures. We've had several that have allowed us to do that, but most will not. So to be honest, a lot of projects, especially in the public sector where there's schools or health centers, to be honest, a lot of times there is no money to replace those batteries because the government ministries in charge of those sites, whether it's education ministry or health ministry, simply don't have the resources. You know, we're talking thousands of dollars to replace batteries. And in many of these countries, they're having a hard time paying their doctors and nurses and buying medicine. So, however, there's help. There's hope on the horizon there also. We're currently involved with a project funded by United Nations Foundation in Ghana and Uganda, where the governments are actually stepping up and they're putting money in their annual budgets to replace equipment.
Do you think that batteries are going to get cheaper and longer lasting in future? I've read about the Tesla lithium battery, for instance. Is that something that's relevant to solar power or not?
Yeah, definitely. There's a number of technologies under development right now. Essentially, lithium and some non-lithium technologies are creating longer lasting batteries. So that's definitely a plus. Right now, those batteries are not cheaper. They're actually more expensive. Maybe in a life cycle costing, they're cheaper, but they definitely cost more money up front. And so they're not affordable for many projects, you know, with the money you're given up front. But there's definitely hope in that area, no question. I think battery technology eventually will get to the point where it's not as much of a problem, but it will still be a challenge.
Some of the areas you've worked in, such as Rwanda and Haiti, have had extremely violent conflicts. So I'm wondering if you've had scary experiences where you thought your life was in danger. We hear plenty of stories of aid workers worldwide being killed, for instance. Have you encountered any violence or any threats to your life?
Personally, no. The scariest times I've had were back in that Nigeria project, actually. And the scariest people were the police. There's roadblocks everywhere where they try and extort a little bit of money, they say, for water. And I am told by my cohorts there that those very same policemen become the robbers at night. And the way they know is that they see the same boots on the robbers as they see on the police. And one of my cohorts there had a bullet wound in the head from a nighttime robbery. One time in Nigeria, we were traveling and we received advance notice that there was violent rioting going on in the village we were about to pass through. So we had warning and we were able to bypass that. So I've been around that kind of things, but I've never felt personally threatened. In Haiti, I've been driving in Port-au-Prince and seen bodies on the street. Our crew there has had some hairy experiences. Riots can break out there almost any time. And people are very dissatisfied about a lot of things in Haiti. Riots are common, as well as robberies and hijacking. Fortunately, none of our crew has ever been injured or hurt, but we've had some close calls.
What areas these days still have no access to electricity? Are there a lot of them around the third world nations?
Yeah, absolutely. When SELF started this work in 1990, the common number used was 1.7 billion people without electricity in the world. Well, the good news is that the commonly used number now is down to 1 billion. So the progress has definitely been made. Most of that progress, I believe, has been made in Asia and in South America. So Africa is still, to use the phrase, is still, in terms of electricity, it's still the dark continent. There's very interesting photographs of Earth at night where you can see light, and Africa still has, you know, it's still 80% dark. You can see the cities, you can see Lagos, you can see Johannesburg, but much of Africa is still dark. So of the billion people or so without electricity, the majority of them are probably in Africa.
There's a connection between energy poverty and lack of clean water as well. So access to electricity can sometimes mean the difference between life and death, can't it?
Absolutely. Drinking water in many developing countries, and I can speak about Africa mainly because that's where most of my experience has been, people still get a lot of water from rivers and lakes, which is untreated and unhealthy. Many places there are hand pumps or foot pumps. For a couple of decades, those were installed all over Africa. However, again, sustainability has been a problem. And most places where we go, those pumps are broken and not working. So where electricity comes in a couple different ways. We've had great success with solar water pumping, just about in most of the countries where we've worked, especially in Benin, West Africa. We've done a lot of drinking water wells with our partner NGO there. And that's a beautiful use of solar technology because it's what's called direct solar without batteries. So you completely bypass the sustainability problem. And the pumps that we use, you can put them down the well and basically forget about them for 8 to 10 years or more. And I've seen that happen. I've gone to villages where there's solar water pump, and I've asked, when is the last time somebody, it's working, and when is the last time somebody came to check that pump? And the elders are scratching their head. And it's like, well, I think they installed it 10 years ago and we haven't seen anyone since. So solar water pumps are an extremely robust technology, low-tech, essentially, and they run for a long time, and they're fairly low-cost.
So, and the water is clean, then, that comes from the wells. How does that work?
Typically, a borehole, when you drill a well, you know, and put it in a pipe, we test it. But, you know, the water coming out of those wells 90% of the time is tested perfectly good to drink. It's aquifer water, it's deep water. We're not treating any of that water in the wells that we've installed, and it's perfectly good. The other way that solar electricity can help with water is in purification. In fact, just this week in Haiti, we're going to be installing the first of two solar water purifiers. And these are high volume purifiers that are able to do about 19,000 liters per day. So they're village scale. That's something we've been wanting to do in Haiti for quite a while because, as people may know, there's been several different incidents of cholera outbreaks that have killed thousands of people in Haiti. Drinking water remains a huge problem there and in many parts of Africa.
How is your organization funded? Is it foundations like Bill and Melinda Gates, the UN, governments, government grants? How do you get your money?
All of the above, and private individuals and corporations. We are strictly a project-based organization. You know, we don't offer steady services or products or anything. We live and die by projects. Sometimes money comes to us, and sometimes we have to look for it. Many places we will start working and somebody finds out what we're doing and that attracts more donors. Rwanda is an example of that. We started working there 10, 12 years ago when the HIV/AIDS programs were really big, really well funded. And we started working for organizations like Partners in Health and then other organizations like Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health found out we were doing projects, so they started funding us to do projects in Rwanda. Then Clinton Foundation jumped into it, so it kind of mushrooms from there. The same thing in Haiti. We were asked to come there before the earthquake by Partners in Health to do health centers. At that time, we were really the only high competency organization doing solar in Haiti, so our work mushroomed after that. But our funding comes from, you know, organizations like that, other NGOs like health NGOs. We've been funded by USAID. We've been funded by the British Aid Agency, DFID. We've been funded by several different branches of the UN. And then we have our angel donators, private individuals who like what we do and will continue to support us from project to project.
There's been a lot of criticism about Western governments mismanaging foreign aid programs. So do you have any opinions about that, having been in the field?
I don't think that we have personally experienced, or as an organization, that we've experienced mismanagement. We are very much on the ground. We're what you call a last mile organization. We are working with the actual beneficiaries. So we see, you know, the money flows from the donor to us, and we see every dollar going to work where it's supposed to work. Where we are sometimes frustrated is that when we work for some of the large multinational organizations, and I'm not going to name names, but their process is so slow and ponderous that it takes way too long to get money to do the projects. And of course, we don't even know how much of that money is absorbed by the multinational organization. We just know what funnels down to us. But that can be frustrating. The larger the organization we work for, the more frustrating it is. The more reporting, the more time you have to spend on reporting. There seems to be waste there.
Paperwork,
financial reports, too many mindless reports that really aren't to the point. You know, you may write 10 reports to an organization, but they never quite manage to make it to the field to actually see what you've done. So that can be frustrating. However, we're grateful even for that money because it is doing a lot of work, a lot of good.
How do you prevent aid money and grants going to local politicians and warlords rather than being used for the projects? Here I'm talking about bribery and corruption in various third world countries.
Yeah, well, again, fortunately, that's not been a problem for us because, you know, we are given money by whoever's donating it. We control that money and we don't bribe anybody. The project in Nigeria that I keep referring to.
That was in 2003?
I believe so. Yeah, around there. Our local partner there, the NGO, we purposely divided the work so that their money, because they provided about a third of the money for the project, and actually the U.S. government, through the Department of Energy, provided two-thirds. We made sure that their money was used for all local processes. And that was deliberate so that we knew that our money, the U.S. taxpayer money, was not going to be paying any bribes. So they had their work. We didn't ask too many questions about how they spent theirs. That was the only project I've ever worked on where there might have been some involvement with government. Typically, we don't have to do that.
Robert Guest's book, The Shackled Continent, talks about all kinds of corruption in Africa. He wrote it in 2003, and there's one story about a beer truck going through from one end of Cameroon to another, and he stopped 47 times by roadblocks where police are shaking him down to get bribes. He's accompanying the people who are moving the beer from one area to another. And so that is one of the problems people see in Africa, you know, a lot of bribery, a lot of corruption. Is that still the case throughout Africa these days? You've been intimately involved with the continent. Is there hope for the future? What countries there are most likely to succeed economically, do you think?
Big questions there. And I've personally experienced what you've talked about. Actually, working in Benin, I had to go to Nigeria. I had to drive from Cotonou, Benin, to Lagos. And interesting experience. It was fine to the border, but once I entered Nigeria, about every kilometer, we were stopped by some guy in a different uniform and a gun asking for a little bit of money. And this went on and on and on. I mean, it was ridiculous. I was starting to laugh after a while. But fortunately, we had picked up a woman at the border. She worked for the immigration department there. She was Nigerian. And she asked if we could give her a lift to her village, which was about 10 kilometers away. And we said, sure, hop in. Well, after a while, she had enough of this stopping. And she got out and just tore into these guys with guns and said, what are you doing? Leave these people alone. Let us go. And that finally put a stop to it. But, you know, that happens. And certainly some countries it still happens in. To answer your question about hope, yes. We've worked in countries that I think are very hopeful. Rwanda is one of them, where I think there's really a minimum of corruption. You don't even offer to bribe a policeman there because you will end up in jail. And I think that's, a lot of NGOs recognize that Rwanda is a great place to work because the government is not only not a hindrance, but they actually help you do your work there. And, there are other political concerns people have with Rwanda, but in terms of corruption, I think there's little or none in a country like that. Other countries like Ghana, I think, are very well functioning. And as I mentioned before, in our UNF project with health centers in Ghana and Uganda, we're seeing governments step up to the plate in terms of sustainability, too. So over the course of my career, I'm definitely seeing an improvement in Africa. Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, too, I'm very hopeful for Africa. And it's mainly because of Africans. There's just incredible human resources there of ambitious, intelligent, well-trained people who are just waiting for an opportunity. And I think as their governments come into line, I think we're going to see Africa really blossom in the next decade or two.
So is that how your work has changed over the years, so that you're now finding sufficiently skilled people in these less developed countries in Africa to be able to train to do some of the work that you would have to do yourself in the past?
Absolutely. And again, this United Nations Foundation project in Ghana and Uganda, which is to do 52 health centers. We are strictly relying on local companies as our partners there. And we're really impressed with their capabilities. They're very professional in every way. Whereas when we started in Africa, we'd have a hard time finding anybody who is trained to do solar. And now there's first-rate companies that are doing it themselves. And I think that's quite common in Eastern Africa and countries like Uganda, Rwanda. It's starting to happen more in West Africa. South Africa, of course, is more developed, and there's a lot of competent companies there. So it's definitely a trend. And in countries, where we can help that, like in Haiti, where we can develop long-term professional training, that's one of our major objectives for the future, is to do capacity building wherever we can.
I have to mention one thing I noticed on your website. Although best known for his portrayal of oil baron J.R. Ewing in the TV series Dallas, the late actor Larry Hagman was one of your board members. So he's famous as a TV oilman. Anti-conservation, anti-renewable energy. In real life, was he a hero for renewable energy?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We were fortunate enough to have a strategic planning session at his place in California. And he has a huge solar array that was powering that place. And this was a couple years before he died, but it was really magical to spend some time with him. He was really a very warm, caring individual, totally behind our mission.
And completely opposite to the character he played on television then.
Totally. Totally. I think the only characteristic that carried through is he's still a bit of a rogue, and he was in real life. He was a lot of fun, put it that way.
Jeff Lahl, project director for SELF, the Solar Energy Light Fund that brings electricity to third world communities that have never had electricity before. Thank you so much for talking to me on the show.
You're welcome. A pleasure.
Radio CJ was presented and produced by CJ Grace. Thank you for listening.